I'm Tracy Sable tonight on EWTN News Nightly. Stepping aside, reaction pours in after Joe Biden says he will not run for re-election. We're at the White House with the latest, the next steps. We also examine the calls from Republicans for the president to resign immediately. Capitol grilling. The head of the U.S. Secret Service faces some tough questions from lawmakers following the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump. And the body of Christ. Tens of thousands of pilgrims flocked to Indianapolis for the National Eucharistic Congress. We have a recap. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Mary Magdalene. Our top story tonight, after the politically stunning announcement by President Joe Biden that he is dropping out of the race for the White House, Vice President Kamala Harris seeks to take over the campaign. She scheduled a visit today with campaign staff in Delaware trying to solidify her spot at the top of the ticket. But her record on abortion follows her wherever she goes. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, tonight, Vice President Kamala Harris does not appear to have any rivals. She's currently the only Democratic candidate. Now, today, she filled in for President Biden here at the White House for an event, not speaking about her own candidacy, but instead his legacy.
On the South Lawn of the White House, at an event honoring NCAA championship teams, Vice President Kamala Harris begins by praising President Joe Biden.
His honesty, his integrity, his commitment to his faith and his family.
Harris working fast to lock up Democratic delegates behind her campaign for the Oval Office after Biden dropped out and freed his delegates to vote for whomever they choose.
And I am firsthand witness that every day our President Joe Biden fights for the American people, and we are deeply, deeply grateful for his service to our nation.
As she vies to win in November, Harris will no doubt continue her pro-abortion push. She was the only vice president to visit an abortion clinic.
So I'm here at this health care clinic to uplift the work that is happening in Minnesota as an example of what true leadership looks like.
Harris has been front and center in the administration calling for Roe to be restored and attending pro-abortion rallies, blasting Donald Trump.
Former President Trump handpicked three Supreme Court justices because he intended for them to overturn Roe.
Her boss, President Biden, also a proponent of abortion, tweeted yesterday his support of Harris, writing, "My fellow Democrats, I have decided not to accept the nomination and to focus all my energies on my duties as president for the remainder of my term. My very first decision as the party nominee in 2020 was to pick Kamala Harris as my vice president, and it's been the best decision I've made. Today, I want to offer my full support and endorsement for Kamala to be the nominee of our party this year. Democrats, it's time to come together and beat Trump. Let's do this." Former President Trump, who recently survived an assassination attempt, rips on both Biden and Harris.
"So who would you like to most run against if you're us, if we want to win? Ready? Kamala Harris."
His campaign adds, "Kamala Harris is just as much of a joke as Biden is. Harris will be even worse for the people of our nation than Joe Biden."
Now, President Biden will deliver remarks later this week, and up until yesterday, his campaign was planning fundraisers and events and setting up travel over the next few weeks. For now, he remains at Rehoboth Beach recovering from COVID, and his doctor said today, releasing a statement, quote, "The president's symptoms have almost resolved completely," end quote. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Owen. So what is next for the Democrats to help answer that question for us? Let's bring in Michael Thorney. He is the director of structural democracy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Michael, welcome. Good to be with you today. So what happens now with the delegates?
Well, what happens, is the decision is uniquely in the hands of the delegates in the way that it only partially was before. the way Democratic Party rules and conventions work, there were two classes of delegates, really. You had a class of delegates who were committed delegates who basically were assigned to a candidate through the state primaries. Then you have a class of other delegates, sometimes called superdelegates, who are sort of party elders and leaders in the party. Now we're in a situation where they uniquely just have a lot of deference to choose the person who will represent the party in a way that delegates at a convention have not had since the early 1970s.
And what about the donors and that huge war chest that Biden has accumulated?
Well, you know, campaign finance and fundraising is an ongoing process for campaigns. It's never done. It does seem likely that Vice President Harris is going to, inherit that campaign account. Her name was already on it officially, and paperwork was filed yesterday with the Federal Election Commission to solidify that. But what we've also seen in, just the last 18 or so hours is that, there's been a huge increase in fundraising by the Democratic Party. And so I think from that, we can conclude that Vice President Harris is going to continue to raise her own money to support her candidacy as the campaign rolls out.
Yeah. And let's talk about the voters here. I mean, more than 14 million people voted for Biden. Do you think they're feeling disenfranchised right now? And do you think maybe they're owed an explanation here or even an apology?
It's difficult to say at this point. You know, I think we know a few things is that, you know, those 14 million voters were almost entirely members of the Democratic Party. There weren't very many races where you had independents participating. So these are our party stalwarts. Some polling of party members in recent weeks show that they were fairly unhappy with President Biden as their nominee. Combining that with the fact that there wasn't really a competitive primary, which usually there isn't for an incumbent, it's not clear that voters are actually upset with this decision. And I think some might actually say that they were hoping for this. Certainly there was pretty widespread debate within Democratic circles about who should be the candidate after last month's debate.
Michael, really quickly here, almost out of time, but I want to talk with the Republicans. Some are saying that if Biden isn't fit to run for office again, then he isn't fit to actually be in office. Do you think they have a point here? And can President Biden effectively lead the country right now?
Well, you know, I think that's up for debate. But, you know, even the Wall Street Journal editorial board had a piece out this morning concluding that, yes, there's a difference between President Biden running for re-election and him serving out the remaining months of his term. But, Republicans have lots of tools, at their disposal if they really want to dig deeper into this question.
All right. We have to leave it right there. Michael, great to be with you. Thank you for your time today and insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
As Democratic lawmakers hail President Biden's historic decision not to seek re-election, Republicans are questioning the president's ability to serve the country.
This is about turning the page. Look at all the contrast now. The other side has a nominee that can barely get a sentence out. He's approaching 80. He brings us back to the past. We have somebody who's about the future of our country, who's put criminals behind bars, who knows firsthand how to do the job.
And he came to it in an amazing way. He did what George Washington and Teddy Roosevelt did, decided, even though I can run again, even though I've been a good president, even though I want to run again, it's the right moment to pass the torch. And that's what Democrats are doing. We're passing the torch.
I mean, Vice President, Senator J.D. Vance said that he should. I think the American people understand that. What I'm focused on is winning. I don't care. I don't think it matters who the Democrats put up.
She will not be tougher to beat, no, not at all. We are excited about Kamala being at the top of the ticket, and I have suggested that the president should resign. The reason is, if everyone acknowledges that he is incapable of running a campaign, then he's clearly incapable of running the country.
And while the Democrats and Republicans have vastly different views about President Biden's decision, they have one thing in common. The U.S. presidential contest has turned into a whole different race in a little more than 24 hours. And that brings in a lot of questions about the election process. Sad for legal analysis. Let's go to Derek Mueller, an election law expert and professor at the University of Notre Dame. Derek, good to see you again. We appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit more about this handover, if you will, from President Biden to Vice President Harris. A lot of people are asking, can this really be done legally? Your thoughts?
Yeah, legally, there's really not much to say about it because there's a recognition that the parties at their nominating convention choose the nominee. And right now, there is no nominee for the Democratic Party. Just like last week, there wasn't a nominee for the Republican Party until they got through their convention and nominated Donald Trump formally. So it takes a majority of the delegates to do that. And there's plans right now for Democrats to hold a virtual roll call, an online component where they will vote sometime in that first week of August. And when they do that, the delegates are going to vote for the candidate they want. They will nominate, in all likelihood, Kamala Harris and a vice presidential candidate. That will be the party's nominee, and then that nominee's name will be transmitted out to the 50 states.
Derek, when do you think we could potentially run into ballot access issues from a legal standpoint?
Yeah, there are some ballot access issues at the end of August. That is, the state of Washington requires by August 20th that states that parties have submitted their nomination. Other states like California, Montana, Oregon, Virginia, or Oklahoma, Virginia, they move very quickly after that. So the end of August is kind of a hard stop date for Democrats. And I think Democrats were looking at the calendar and the election calendar and wondering whether or not they were going to meet some of those deadlines because their convention is scheduled to be in Chicago August 19th. And that's really cutting it close. So there's a reason why they're moving to this virtual roll call and the opportunity to perhaps wrap up the nomination by perhaps around August 5th.
There are some groups that are threatening to sue to prevent Biden from being taken off the ballot. Is that something that's even possible?
Yeah, I don't think those lawsuits will go anywhere if anybody filed them. You know, there's a lot of information floating around ballot access deadlines that have passed in certain states, pointing out Alabama or Indiana or other states. But those are ballot access deadlines for other offices, for Senate, for governor, whatever it might be. States are very clear that they separate presidential elections because they just look different. They know that the parties are holding their nominating contests in the late summer, especially Republicans and Democrats. They hold them very late. So they accommodate those conventions by having pretty late ballot access deadlines. So it's important not to confuse those other deadlines from the presidential ones, which are unique to each state. And additionally, you know, there is no nominee yet. So there's no problem in removing Biden's name because his name isn't on the ballot in any state. It will be on the ballot or it could be in a few weeks.
Derek, I want to quickly switch gears here now. Speaker Johnson has been clear in saying that if Biden can't run for re-election, then he's unfit to be president now. We've been hearing that. But he even cited the 25th Amendment as a way to remove Biden. I want to get your thoughts on that. And can the 25th Amendment be used in this instance?
Now, the 25th Amendment is very difficult to use with a president who is sort of sentient and able to sign paperwork and think and speak. So, you know, that sounds a little odd. But the point of the 25th Amendment is to allow the vice president, a majority of the cabinet, to step in when the president is unable. But if the president signs paperwork saying he is able and reasserts that authority, the vice president and a majority of the cabinet have to come to Congress. And then it takes a two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress to declare the president unable. So that's getting the vice president, the cabinet, and two-thirds of each house of Congress to declare a president is unable. I think at this point, Joe Biden, who has signed paperwork just this week declaring that he's not running for re-election, would be able to reassert that authority. I think the 25th Amendment is not a viable option going forward.
Is there any other way they could possibly take him out of office if they don't use the 25th?
I mean, really, your options are impeachment, which is a majority of the House, and then, again, two-thirds of the Senate to convict, although you'd have to identify high crime or misdemeanor if that's the case. And the other option is sort of a pressure campaign. I think there's no question that Democrats used significant pressure on Joe Biden in the last month to suggest that he shouldn't run for re-election. We'll see if that same kind of pressure campaign from Republicans can convince him to perhaps step down ahead of the election, but that remains to be seen.
Yeah, we will see what happens. Definitely interesting times. Derek, thank you so much for your insights. Always appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
President Biden's decision to step aside has sparked reaction from around the world, and here is just a sample of what they're saying.
I respect the decision that he has now made. Not an easy decision, but a decision that I know that he will have arrived at taking into account the best interests of the American people. And I look forward to working with him for the remainder of his presidency.
And I will tell my friends on both sides of the aisle that regardless who the American people choose as their next president, Israel remains America's indispensable and strong ally in the Middle East.
Frankly speaking, the developments that we have seen in the United States in recent years have taught us not to be surprised with anything. And so we weren't surprised with it that much.
Well, it has been a little over a week since the assassination attempt against former President Donald Trump, and lawmakers are demanding answers from the Secret Service about the security breakdown. The agency's director was on the hot seat today testifying during a very tense House hearing. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with the latest. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. The big question lawmakers want answered, how could the Secret Service fail so miserably? How could an untrained 20-year-old gunman get on the roof within 150 yards of a former president, fire more than a half a dozen shots, killing a spectator and wounding several others before finally being taken out?
The Secret Service's solemn mission is to protect our nation's leaders. On July 13th, we failed. As a director of the United States Secret Service, I take full responsibility for any security lapse of our agency.
But members of the Oversight Committee say it was preventable and demand she resign.
It is my firm belief, Director Cheadle, that you should resign. However, in complete defiance, Director Cheadle has maintained she will not tender her resignation.
Not only should you resign, if you refuse to do so, President Biden needs to fire you because his life, Donald Trump's life, and all the other people which you protect are at risk.
Thank question you, after question, the Secret director Service Cheadle director failed to provide specifics, only that it's under investigation.
Have you talked to the counter sniper who took the shot that took out the bad guy?
Yes, I have.
And can you tell us about that conversation?
I would not want to reveal conversations that I've had with my employees.
But that's exactly the kind of information the American people want to know, American people who pay your salary.
I understand. This is an ongoing investigation.
Was there ever a moment where the Secret Service actually considered pausing the rally?
The Secret Service would have paused the rally had they known or been
told there
was an actual threat.
The answer is no. Correct?
I can speak to you in generalities.
No, I don't want generalities.
I
want specifics. The answer is no. You did not consider pausing the rally.
The director did admit the roof where the shooter opened fire was identified as a potential vulnerability days before the event.
In the 5 days prior, when the security advance team did their work, did they identify the rooftop as a potential threat?
Again, I'm pulling those reports and that information.
It's been 9 days, Madam Director. Did they notice a rooftop 150 yards away that was a potential threat? Yes or no?
I am certain that the rooftop was noted.
Is the Secret Service fully cooperating with our committee?
Yes.
Has the Secret Service provided this committee a complete list of all law enforcement personnel that were there that day? Have you done that? Have you provided a list to the Oversight Committee? Yes or no?
I'll have to get back to you on that.
That is a no.
Bottom line, lawmakers say the Secret Service director provided more information to the media than to Congress. Tomorrow, the investigation into the attempted assassination of the former president continues. The House Homeland Security Committee has subpoenaed DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to appear along with local Pennsylvania law enforcement involved in the security arrangements. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including deadly protests. Dozens of people are dead amid bloodshed in Bangladesh. And why hundreds of people in a humanitarian zone in the Middle East are being forced to evacuate. Welcome back. More than 150 people are dead in Bangladesh after a week of violent protests. Well, demonstrators say that they are pushing back against a controversial jobs proposal. 30% of government jobs were reserved for relatives of veterans who took part in the country's independence. Despite the Supreme Court's order to cut the quota, protesters now have a new string of demands. And now to the war in the Middle East, where the Israeli military orders the evacuation of people from a humanitarian zone. The evacuations took place amid loud explosions. The military said that it is planning an operation against Hamas militants who have embedded themselves in the area. The order means hundreds of displaced people are on the move once again. Well, the Vatican Secretary of State is in Ukraine this week. It is Cardinal Pietro Parolin's first visit to the country since the start of the Russian invasion in 2022. According to Vatican News, Parolin said the Pope was following the situation in Ukraine with, quote, so much worry and so much pain, as he visited a heavily bombarded city over the weekend and celebrated Mass at a popular Marian shrine. The Cardinal also urged Catholics and clergy not to lose hope and that a path to peace can be found. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a pivotal moment for the Catholic Church. Tens of thousands of pilgrims united in prayer.
A week of Eucharistic revival here in Indianapolis. I'm Mark Irons. I've got the story for you coming up.
The 10th National Eucharistic Congress is in the history books, and it was a groundswell of spiritual renewal for the tens of thousands who participated in Indianapolis and the thousands more who watched it right here on EWTN. Reporter Mark Irons shares the highlights.
The experience of the 10th National Eucharistic Congress, the first one in more than 80 years, is captured by the people.
I love it.
Being with everyone in the presence of Jesus.
Really excited to just be together as one with thousands of people.
Over the course of 5 days, around 60,000 Catholics, the young, old, and families converged in Indianapolis from all over the U.S. Anchored together by Jesus Christ present in the Eucharist. Joining the crowd, pilgrims who spent the last 2 months processing from different corners of America to be here. Each day provided the chance for Mass, prayer, service, and breakout sessions covering a vast number of topics. A large exhibit hall showcased lay Catholic apostolates, and throughout the Congress, the universal nature of the Church broke through as there was something for everyone. The diversity and unity of Catholicism was found in different music, liturgies, and languages. Each night of the Congress provided uplifting song. And Catholic speakers shared inspiring messages.
Thank God!
Remember that God loves you. He loves you so much.
The Eucharist for me is healing. The Eucharist for me is peace.
We are so blessed to have the Eucharist every day at Mass, at every chapel.
And this professional football stadium, no stranger to screaming sports fans throughout the year, fell silent as 50,000 people spent time in Eucharistic adoration.
The Eucharist for me and for us as Catholics means we have intimacy with Christ. And I think sometimes we forget that. We don't just have a personal relationship. We actually have intimacy with him in the Eucharist, and it's just an amazing thing.
I've actually been studying John in our Bible study. And so as a former Protestant, this year has just really hit home for me with just the true meaning of the Eucharist and Christ's presence. Our daughter Ava was her first communion this year, so we're pretty excited about that.
And as tens of thousands gathered in the streets of Indianapolis, it was those children who have recently received their first communion leading the way for a joy-filled, mile-long Eucharistic procession. Followed by public adoration and benediction at the Indiana War Memorial.
God forever and ever.
With the closing Mass, this historic event in the life of the U.S. Church wrapped up. But there was a sending forth.
Share the gospel with confidence. Guys, lean into community, lean into praying a lot, lean into worship, lean into serving the poor.
To further ignite what was sparked here.
To go out to the ends of the earth, to every generation.
Mark Irons, EWTN News Nightly.
No Organizers say there will be another Eucharistic pilgrimage in 2025, this time from Indianapolis to California. The next National Eucharistic Congress is set for 2033. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.